we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Well, prior to 2014, Crimea was a place and a word that we, most of us, associated with history. The Crimean War of the mid-19th century, involving the Russian and British empires fighting for control and access to Central Asia at that time, part of the so-called Great Game. We've all seen the movie with Errol Flynn, the charge of the Light Brigade, the iconography, Florence Nightingale and so forth. But all that changed in 2014, in January of 2014 to be precise, with the Ukrainian crisis, whereupon the elected government led by Viktor Yanukovych was unceremoniously toppled in a coup involving the participation of avowed neo-Nazis and fascists. And in March of that year, Crimea seceded, some would say was annexed, by Russia after a referendum in which 93% of people who voted elected to rejoin the Russian Federation. Crimea, you should know, has a long history of being part of Russia. It became part of Russia in 1783 under Catherine the Great. It was then transferred to the jurisdiction of Ukraine by the then Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Ukraine then being part of the Soviet Union. But even though Crimea has been prominent in the news since 2014, many of us do not know what's actually going on there. It still evokes an exotic image, given its history, and we don't really know what the people think. The Crimea's existed at a level of geopolitics, and lost in that geopolitical rendering of Crimea since 2014 has been the human story. But all that's about to change with a documentary that's been made by Graham Phillips, an independent journalist who's reported widely from Ukraine throughout the Ukrainian crisis and conflict. And it follows the fortunes of a lone Scotsman who travels to Crimea for the first time. And we get to see through his eyes what is actually going on in Crimea. I'm John White and this is Hard Facts. Not only are we going to look at this documentary, we're going to do so in the company of Graham Phillips, the aforesaid journalist, and Les Scott, who is the subject of this documentary. And I'm delighted to say that they join me now in the studio. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, John. Excellent. Delighted to be with you.
Well, Graham, give us a 411 documentary. What's it all about? What was the idea? Where did it come from?
It's cool. Well, we've been filming it yesterday, and today filming goes on and will go on because while it was last summer that we took Les to my left to Crimea and his halls and his holidays, the idea is to make a kind of all-encompassing documentary that shows not only the going to Crimea, the actual having of a holiday in Crimea, but then the kind of, to call it the aftermath, sounds a bit like it's a disaster. But in fact, when you read the news and the coverage of Crimea, that's exactly what you would be led to believe you were in for if you were going to Crimea. In fact, I think Les can kind of chime in here and go through the process, how it all kind of came about.
Yeah, Les, what was your participation? How did you get involved?
Well, really, I'd been following some of Graham's work, and when he first spoke to me about going to Crimea, thankfully, I didn't know too much about what was going on. I knew there'd been a referendum and I knew there was a bit of, you know, debate as to who Crimea belonged to and whether or not it was had been annexed and if the people there were living under some sort of occupied regime. So thankfully, like a lot of people, you know, who even spoke to before I went there, that we didn't really know much about Crimea. It certainly wasn't a holiday destination that you would find in the travel agents, you know, if you were planning a holiday. So when, after I'd agreed to do it, and then we sort of started to look into the logistics of it, some of the hard facts, or, well, what appeared to be facts, were coming through, and it was a little bit worrying, you know, for me. And Graham, I knew Graham had been there, but he wasn't really very forthcoming about whether it was something that would be risky or whether I'd be in danger. And looking back, I know the reasons he didn't want to say too much was because he wanted a real account. You know, he wanted to see my reactions, to see how I would deal with, you know, the prospect of doing something that our own government really would advise against, maybe look upon you unfavourably for even going there and doing such a thing against their advice. So,
that calls to mind, that's to your great credit, because a lot of us do accept the line we're fed by our government. That calls to mind Sean Penn. Remember when he went to Iraq in the run-up to the Iraq War on similar grounds, that he wanted to see for himself what was going on there, given the seismic nature of this event. So that's an interesting point you made, that you felt compelled to find out, to look behind the curtain, as it were, to find out for yourself what was going on there.
Yeah, and a lot of it tied in with, you know, we had our own Scottish referendum around about the same time as all this was happening. And I suddenly became aware of, you know, this thing that we're all talking about now, which is the fake news, and you accept what, in particular, what's given to you in the television.
And you became more politicised in the context of the Scottish referendum.
The fact is that we first knew each other, would it be 20 years ago, more than that, on a school exchange we met in 1994 to a Schaffenberg in Germany. But then as the years had passed, you know, we'd fallen out of contact and not seen Les for whenever it was 15 years or something. And we kind of, when Les started following my work over in Donbass in Crimea back from 2014, resumed contact and had seen each other a couple of times. And I was covering Crimea, had done hundreds of videos from there. John had done lots of, you know, reportage. But, you know, you're always looking to sort of make a breakthrough, if you like. And I thought, well, me doing it is one thing, but if I could take someone to Crimea as in an absolute, just someone who has no concept or no notion, someone who's never been and never seen, has no idea about Crimea.
Well, it helps you to engage with people because they can identify with Les.
This is an innocent abroad sort of thing, to put someone in a position that he's never been, he's got no preconceptions, no notions, and just to put him totally raw in that experience of Crimea for himself, then it brings not only a fresh set of eyes to the world in terms of coverage and people all around the globe who will be hopefully watching the documentary, but even for myself it was interesting to see Les, to put Les in that position and to see him there, to see, you know, how he perceived Crimea and how Crimea reacted to him. So, and the idea was the documentary to be absolutely, to use the, you know, the warts and all, to show every side of Crimea, to be, you know, anti-propaganda. Because, I mean, let's be absolutely honest about Crimea. When it comes to Crimea, there's Western propaganda and there's Russian propaganda. And we want it to be absolutely anti-propaganda in this documentary to show actually
as objective as
how
you can
Crimea
possibly
is.
Be. Okay, now, the title of the documentary is A Brit in Crimea, in parentheses, on his holidays.
Yeah.
Very good title. But before we go on, I think let's establish some facts with regards to Crimea. I've been writing on this and commentating on this issue since 2014, but I understand I've been doing so from afar, so it's easy for me. You've been there, so you have on-the-ground knowledge and experience, which is why it's such a privilege that you've joined us here today. I mentioned the crisis in 2014. Now, Russia moved into Crimea immediately thereafter. The Black Sea Fleet was there. It's very important. It had a long-standing treaty with the Ukrainian government, and it had to protect its interests there. But the fact is that of the 2.2 million citizens who live in Crimea, I think it's around 80% are Russian speakers or ethnic Russians. Mm-hmm. So it's heavily populated by Russian ethnic speakers.
Oh, absolutely.
And so the idea that any such referendum would return 93%, which was deemed illegitimate in the West, unsurprisingly, well, that's not delusional. That is very, very factual.
It's
very, very authentic.
I was there for the referendum.
There is a lot of verisimilitude with regards to that result. Now, the people of Kosovo were never given the privilege of a referendum when they unilaterally declared
in 2008.
And this was an independence that the US and the usual suspects peremptorily acknowledged at the time. So there is a lot of hypocrisy surrounding this. But the strong point I would make is if Russia had not moved into Crimea as it did immediately after Viktor Yanukovych was toppled, who was, in my view, the last legitimately democratically elected president of Ukraine, then when this coup government tried to spread it to the rest of the country, especially in Crimea, there would have been an all-out civil war. So in many ways, that civil war in Crimea was averted by Russia taking the prompt action it did. Now, when this happened, where were you based when this actually happened, and how soon did you get to Crimea?
I was in Odessa time, John. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you're obviously an authority on the subject, on the theme of Crimea, and I mean, yeah, I was in Odessa, so what's that?
Now, there was a murder in Odessa. 40 people were burned to death in a trade union hall,
I believe. That was on May the 2nd of 2014. But when I actually went for the first time, it was February the 27th, and everything was escalating. And Yanukovych had just been deposed, and everything had moved the momentum to Crimea. So I literally hopped in my car and hot-footed it 700 kilometres as it was from Odessa, drove kind of through the night to get there. And that was at the time, in fact, when the world's media was telling you that it was the most dangerous place on earth and it was incredibly hostile and they weren't letting anyone in. And I went in this car that had happened after Euromaidan, the kind of wind of a fever had hit the air in Ukraine and things had gone a bit crazy. Someone had even swiped my number plate. So I went in a car with no registration plates, had no documents for accreditation, and they let me in. And what I actually saw in Crimea at that time was an uprising, was a surge, was a kind of, as it was described to me, a cry from the soul for people that just stood up and against the Euromaidan installed government in Ukraine, as it was. And I went back to cover the referendum. So I was there on the day of the referendum. I was there at the time of the referendum. So I covered that and have kept engaged ever since. But unfortunately, it's one of these situations that as soon as you start to cover something that correlates with the Russian side, you get called a Putin propagandist or a Russian propagandist. So that was the kind of attraction
for me.
Believe
me, I've got the scars.
You can't say a thing about Crimea without getting slapped. So that was the attraction for me, is that I knew that my kind of reportage would reach up to a level. But then you get hit immediately with, as I say, with being whatever Putin and Kremlin connected. To the attraction of taking Les was that I absolutely know that Les is someone that speaks his mind. And in fact, you mentioned earlier the referendum, the Scottish independence referendum. And we've got different opinions on a lot of things. I mean, Les is for independence in Scotland. I'm not for Scottish independence. And the beauty of Les is that he's a person that absolutely speaks his own mind in every. So I knew that you could put him in a situation and that he would say exactly as he saw it. And that was the kind of idea of to put a man that is absolutely. I mean, you know, Les is absolutely open. We can even call him a bit blunt sometimes. He says it as he sees it.
Les, what were your preconceived notions of Crimea? And obviously, I know that you said that you didn't really know what to expect, but you must have had some idea of some image of what you're expecting based on the news coverage, or maybe based on your understanding of the history. I mentioned it in my introduction. What were those preconceived notions before you arrived?
First of all, the last thing I thought of Crimea as being would be any sort of holiday destination or anywhere that you could go and relax, you know, and have a good time, or even have things, you know, things to do, you know, because when we go on holiday, we have this idea that we're going to, you know, have a good time and there's going to be the people waiting to make
find
us happy.
Find a British pub somewhere.
Well, that's it, yeah. But at the same time, you know, I was a bit of an avid traveller and I'd been around Europe and all sorts of places. So I was keen to see what the differences were as well. I sort of agreed to do it very loosely. I suppose in a lot of ways I didn't think Graham was probably going to, you know, go on or carry on through with it. But it suddenly very quickly became very real and the crowdfunding started for Graham.
Were you nervous? Was there a level of trepidation?
When the crowdfunding started, and I think it would be fair to say at one point, I knew that Graham was a bit of a controversial figure and I was starting to get nervous about that and I was nervous about my safety. And a few weeks before, I was having second thoughts and I'd said to Graham, look, I don't know, I'm not sure if this is a good idea.
And of course, that's completely understandable given the tempestuous nature of events at that point. I mean, it seemed to be in complete turmoil.
Well, particularly last August, it was all talk of war and a new front opening. And I mean, he was watching this footage and kind of messaging me and be like, are we all right here?
Yeah. The thing is, it would have been very easy for Graham to say, look, you know, trust me, it'll be fine. But he didn't do that at all. He just said, it's very important. You know, what you're about to do is important work. And you have to be, you know, I can't say too much. I just want it to be real and I want you to give your own opinion. So I had to make that call and I had to say, I'm just going to have to go for it. It's once in a lifetime. And you did say that a few times. You said, this is a one-off. It's a once in a lifetime. Has to be done and this is the time to do it. So, you know, and I'm glad I did.
And
so
I remember Les from 1994, a school exchange, saying things exactly as he saw them, and the same in 2016. And that's the whole idea. I mean, and we made this film with no budget. I mean, crowdfunding, you know, barely didn't cover costs, so it kind of had anti-budget. But the idea is it should be absolutely authentic, real and raw, and Crimea just as it is, because the whole kind of idea would come about after I'd interviewed the tourism minister there, and he said that Crimea is, in fact, in all the world, it's got the most tourist attractions per square kilometre, and yet no one from England would ever even think, or Scotland, of course, even from the United Kingdom, would ever even think of going there on holiday. But Les, he did, and he's lived to tell the tale.
Okay, well, listen, chaps, stop there, hold that thought. We'll come back to this right after the break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back right after this. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of this episode of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with journalist Graham Phillips and Les Roberts. We're discussing their documentary, A Brit in Crimea on His Holidays.
Les Scott, my
apologies. Well, I did that, sorry.
You got my middle name, though. That's good.
Okay, that's... and that's me sober as well. So you were talking, interestingly, about how you've met and how the idea came to light and the start of the process. Now, I asked you, Les, just before the break, what were your preconceived notions? What did you take away from the experience and how did it clash with those preconceived notions?
Well, the first thing, I suppose, along with the preconceived notions, my greatest concern as well was the fact that Graham and I are very different. And I was concerned about how the chemistry would work and whether or not it would be, if we'd make a good team and whether I would...
So how long were you there filming?
It was just under 2 weeks,
I think. 2 weeks.
Yeah. Oh, was it just a week?
Oh, was it a week?
It felt like 2 weeks. Because it was so intense. It was so full on. And the idea was to combine an actual holiday with the part of the process that means that it's filmed, but it's still a holiday.
Yeah.
So it's kind of combining that equation of the fact that, you know, that it's a holiday and he was on his holiday, but at the same time, it's a documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're filming. It wasn't like there was a crew. There was myself. There was Patrick, our American kind of cameraman that came along and also had a holiday as well. So we were all sort of on holiday, but it all had to be filmed and we had to do as much as possible in what was less than a week, in fact, in all incredibles, a week to the nail.
So what did you do when you were there? Where did you go? Who did you see? Who did you speak to?
Les.
Yeah, I mean, when we first arrived, the first thing we did actually was drive to a beach, but
it was a rocky start, and it was a rocky beach as well.
But I had been on the road for something like 3 days non-stop, and that's where it worked for us, because the difference in personality and characteristics
comes through
because Graham, as hungry as he is, you know, he was keen to get down there and show me all of Crimea, and I just wanted to go and lie down somewhere and be like,
"This
is
a holiday in Valence."
So that's it. Yeah.
I mean, he did. It was actually, the idea is it actually should capture a real holiday, but it can't be just a holiday film. It can't be someone's holiday video. So it needs to be a real documentary, but at the same time about a real holiday. It was a case of kind of combining it all. But the first day was a bit tough because, I mean, we all kind of came and we'd been in the car for 3 days. We'd driven down from Moscow. And then after that, as in probably any holiday, things just got going and it kind of got its own flow and its own momentum. And by the end, when Les left, it was just this whirlwind that had blown and I just couldn't believe it was over. And then it's kind of now coming back. And the footage, obviously, on a physical level, I got accused of crowdfunding to have a holiday with mates. But on a physical level, there's several thousand video files that are now being made into an actual finished film, which will be out in the summer. And so the actual work that goes into that process is mammoth. But the holiday was fun.
How did you find the people and the culture?
That was the highlight for me, really. You know, what surprised me most is the film is called A Brit in Crimea. And you sort of have the assumption that people are going to be interested in Britain. But Graham always introduced me as a Scottish person, and almost everyone we met, they knew a lot about Scotland. They knew about our culture.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know how many times I was asked to
wear
my
kilt.
Yeah. I was really.
Were you getting the Braveheart speech?
It was good, but people were almost honoured that I'd gone to visit them. And
Been quite humbling. What they're going through. And,
yeah, I'd been travelling around Europe. I'd bought a motorhome and I'd been travelling around Europe just a few months previous. And the thing about Europe is we all go, you know, we go to like Spain, Italy and all these places. You get the feeling sometimes that you're not really appreciated so much as a tourist. You know, it's almost like you can be a bit of a nuisance. And that comes across when you're maybe in a barista, you know, a restaurant or a cafe.
Kind of like familiarity breeds contempt kind of thing. Yeah.
But it was a whole different kettle of fish in Crimea because they didn't see. People would almost be shocked and say, "You're from where? From what are you doing here?"
Were the people there aware of how central they were at that point in terms of the news, world news and so on? Were they aware of that?
They were. And the refreshing thing about it was they knew that they would be cast in a certain light by the West. But it didn't give them any preconceptions about me at all.
Well, that's very encouraging, isn't
it? And they know how, you know, they're almost sort of jokey about it and they say, "Oh yeah, we know what people say," and that in itself tells a tale because it shows that they were relaxed, you know, they weren't paranoid. At no point did anyone shy away from us. In fact, it was quite the opposite. As soon as we set up our cameras, because we would arrive somewhere at a tourist spot and I would be trying to take things in, Graham would be setting the camera up to start filming, and immediately people were coming over and they're interested and they want to know what you're doing. And of course, Graham, you know, every time he would always say, "Well, this is the guy here, go and speak to Les, he's from Scotland."
And so I have to ask you the question, were the people supportive of rejoining the Russian Federation, the people that you met?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, I look at articles now since I've come back and, you know, I'm doing the comparison, and the big thing is, it's the whole see for yourself, you know, so many people are telling you about Crimea and giving you all this information and sometimes even getting really passionate about it. I see some of the people on Twitter, you know, and the things they say to Graham.
They're already accusing this of being a propaganda film. They've not seen anything from it, but they're already saying it's propaganda just because they're scared it's not going to correlate with the view that they want to present of Crimea. But actually, if Les will tell you about some of the interviews that we did, and the interviews as it happened, John, I mean, I kind of pitched up, and to start with, you've got that kind of journalistic fear that you need enough material kind of in the can so you can start to take your foot off the gas a little bit. So for the first kind of few hours, I was full on, have to film something. After a couple of days, I relaxed. There was one evening that we just went out. We'd just been in the pub. We'd been, you know, met up with a few mates, been in Simferopol, been relaxing, a bit of wine. And Les kind of wandered off with Patrick, didn't know what they were doing. And it turns out they filmed this interview with this pro-Ukrainian guy that went on for like 15 minutes. So I've been watching back through this footage. And that's actually the longest interview in the film, as you you can maybe tell a bit more about it yourself.
Yeah.
This guy that's pro-Ukrainian.
All right, so you met pro-Ukrainian voices as well.
We had to put every side, but what was he...
And that's the thing, is that, you know, people will say, laugh and say, there must be loads of pro-Ukrainians in Crimea, you know, or the West might have you believe that there's full of them, but we genuinely struggled to find, and we wanted it because we wanted the film to show balance.
Wanted that balance, yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise it would just look like it was a propaganda. So when we finally did find one, it was, and it was near the end of the week as well, we'd found a couple, but we hadn't found anyone with real substance that, you know, that had passion about it.
Yeah.
And this young lad, he had a lot of passion. He was, you know, he was a passionate supporter of Crimea being part of Ukraine. And he happened to be with his best friend who was with him on his bike. He didn't speak very much, but he was the opposite. He was pro-Russia.
Wow.
So first thing there is they were good friends. Yeah. They had different opinions.
And they remained friends. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, but you know, the guy was quite emotional, and he spoke about his heritage, and his father was from Kiev, and he really, you know, supported his father's views, and he understood them. And it was quite a touching interview for me because I could see that he was a bright young lad and he was at university and he was studying and he was just talking about what he believed in.
In a very passionate way.
Yeah, in a passionate way. And, you know, no one can blame him for that. And what comes out of the film in the end is you have to listen to real people. You have to go there and you have to speak to people.
And you have to listen to the other side of the argument.
And we met, you know, there was another guy from Kiev, in fact, had come on his holidays, you remember, at Levada, and did an interview with him. He'd actually come from Ukraine in Kiev and spoke to Les for another sort of long interview.
But yeah, going back to looking at some of the articles now, you know, from people who haven't been there, or maybe they have, and like I read one in the BBC recently where they had some guy was talking about they pick out certain things which are true. So for example, there's billboards with Putin on them and little messages, you know, try to give people the confidence, and it's they say, oh, they make a big deal about that, and well, yeah, there are things like that around, but they don't mention things like the infrastructure. You know, when we first arrived off the ferry, that road, I'm surprised I survived it. It was just so bad.
It was quite underdeveloped.
Yeah, but then the first thing we saw as we got into the main cities was, you know, construction going on. All these roads are getting redeveloped and there's money being spent there. Mm. And when you speak to people and you ask them, so how are you finding things? How if it's only been 2 years? Quite a lot of people say, well, you know, the jury's still out there, but yeah, the roads are getting better. Things have gotten a little bit more expensive, but then you can maybe put that down to sanctions.
Yeah,
so people
and
are...
We filmed in the week, you know, Les spoke to dozens and dozens of people in the end. And, I mean, the idea of the film was not to make a brochure. It was absolutely anti that, so no kind of tourism brochure. It was getting away from all this flag-waving. It was actually to show the actuality, the reality. And as Les says yourself, you get that through people. And of the dozens of people you spoke to and interviewed, I mean, what was the, you know, what were they saying in terms of...
Yeah, I mean... The humbling thing, again, for me was just the welcome, you know. They were very welcoming. But most people, in fact, almost everyone we spoke to, they were delighted. And there's a lot of patriotism goes with that. In fact, I learned when I was over there that most of the, you know, the Crimean people have a lineage that goes back to Russia because 50 years ago or something, it was part of Russia.
Yeah, that's right.
So
I mentioned that.
The parents and the grandparents will all be Russian.
There's a strong connection. That's what's really sad about this crisis, because it split a country unnaturally that was really bound by these historical and familial ties. But
and again, I asked when I was speaking to the guy who was pro-Ukraine, the young lad, and Graham called me a propagandist, which I didn't really know what I was saying. I was genuinely interested in what... Because
I was teasing.
Yeah, I'd been there for about a week.
Because I started asking questions like, you know, what do people think about being Russia here? What do most people want? And I was watching it back and kind of calling as a teasing and being like, gosh, where did you kind of get this? Because we were obviously banter.
The big question for me, I said to him, I said, look, what is the solution here? You know, I'm asking you because obviously if I ask someone who is pro-Russia or, you know... they're going to say, well, leave us alone. Yeah. So I wanted to ask him, I said, what do you think the solution is? What would happen if Crimea was given back to Ukraine? And his response, well, you'll see in the film, but, you know, it was a response that any normal person would imagine. If you're in a country where the majority of people want to be in a situation and you're going against that, there would be an uprising.
Yeah, they would. Graham, You mentioned the word propagandist. I can confirm that you're not a propagandist. I did introduce you as being independent, and you really are independent. You're not being paid for this interview. We're not.
No,
Vladimir Putin's hand is not up our backs telling us what to say. And we don't have a script here, though maybe I should, given that I got Leslie's name wrong earlier. But what attracted you to, I'm intrigued as to your history in Ukraine. What attracted you to that part of the world? Did you have an interest in that part of the world before the crisis, or was it driven by the crisis? And what have you seen in Donbass? We've spoken about Crimea, but let's move on to Donbass, because that's where a lot of the real sort of crisis is taking place right now. What have you seen in Donbass, and what are your views on what the future holds for that part of the world?
I mean, to come back to the point, I mean, obviously, you know, you get accused of being a certain thing. And at the start, when kind of the escalation occurred, Euromaidan, then I worked for Russia Today for a bit and the channel Zvezdar, but that was literally because those were the channels that allowed me to say what I saw, because the whole Western media, it went completely the other side. And I mean, I know Ukraine. I mean, I, you know, show me any pro-Ukrainian and I can honestly say, hand in heart, that I've been to more parts of Ukraine than them. You know, I know the country more than them. And the amount of when it kicked off and I was watching on Facebook all of these from Kiev pro-Ukrainians saying that this part of Ukraine will always be Ukraine, Crimea is always Ukraine, and they've never been, and I know that they've never been because they were my friends of the time. So I mean, I knew Ukraine and I'd lived there for 2 years before Euromaidan started, and I mean, I'd supported Ukraine. I mean, I remember before Euro 2012 when the whole world and its aunt was having a go saying that Ukraine can never host the Euro 2012 football tournament, it's going to be a disaster, the country's an absolute mess, it's chaos and all the rest of it. And I was kind of standing up and saying, no, Ukraine can do it. It's a lovely country. But then unfortunately, it came to the situation with Euromaidan that you can't defend the indefensible. And I mean, I'd been and seen in Kiev and covered, for example, the Party Svoboda, which is the far right, the neo-Nazi party. And then when Euromaidan erupted, I was living in Kiev. I was living in, sorry, Odessa, having lived in Kiev for 2 years. I was living down in Odessa. I was watching it in Kiev. And I saw all these people I'd covered, all these parties and factions and extremists that I'd covered suddenly rising up. And I saw something that you can't support. But
so
yeah,
did you detect something ugly was taking place before it
of
broke
course.
Out?
Of course, and I went to report on Maidan myself, because I always believe you have to go and report from the ground as you see it, and Crimea affords that opportunity, albeit you still need to report things as they are. Whereas with Donbass, let's hope for a resolution. I mean, it's been over 3 years
now. Do you see a way out? What do you see the future?
I always, you know, try and hope for the best, and always try and hope that there'll be a resolution that will give Donbass what the people there want. And in fact, when I'm back in the UK, you know, to be honest, it sort of stings that people here just don't know about it. I mean, you know, I speak to people here and they just don't know what's happening there. They don't know that people are being killed by shelling. Ukrainian shelling goes on every day. I mean, this is Ukraine shelling civilian areas. Every day
this is in violation of the Minsk Agreement.
Houses are getting hit. People are still getting wounded. People are still dying there.
And the majority of people there are, just to be clear, are still determined to reject this
more
coup
so,
government.
More so than ever, because, you know, whatever sentiment there was before pro-Ukraine, you can't now support a Ukraine that has for 3 years relentlessly hit them with shelling, destroyed their homes,
their cities.
So do
those people want to join Russia as well? Do you get that sense, or some of them, or...?
It's, you know, it's hard to say, you know, that in Crimea, the overwhelming will was to be with Russia. But in Donbass, people don't even know if that's in the cards. They don't even know if that's an
possible.
Option. They
it's
don't know if
possible.
That's on the table, basically. Yeah. So what they want is they've got the republics, the Donetsk and the Luhansk People's Republic. They want to be left alone, basically.
They want them to be recognised.
They want to be allowed to just go about their lives and to work and to build something. Because, I mean, you know, when you turn up to a house, it's just been hit by shelling. And there's a man crying saying it took 7 years to build this house. And in 1 minute, it was destroyed. And you see that, unfortunately, what's happened in Donbass is you've allowed destructive forces to take control, and you've allowed it to go to a situation where the dynamic is destruction.
I think Donbass, like Crimea, is just a word. They don't think about the human story behind the word, about the suffering that you've just laid out, about the consequences of the geopolitical decisions taken in capitals thousands of miles away. And this is an indictment of those who view the world as just a grand chessboard on which countries and regions and governments and peoples are just pieces.
If you do it that way, then you get to checkmate, you know, and it's hard to see.
We see it in the Middle East, we see it in Ukraine. It really is an indictment of these people, isn't it? They don't really understand the consequences of some of the decisions that they take. Listen, guys, it's been fantastic. The name of the documentary is A Brit in Crimea on His Holidays. When can we see it? When can we expect
it's going to be out in the summer. I'm working on it now, and so it's going to be out in the summer.
You can catch up with Graham Phillips at his website, www.thetruthspeaker.co. I've been sitting down with Graham Phillips and Les Scott. I got your name right this time, Les. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me. Thank you, most of all, for listening. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.